Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
structure of the solar system, starting from the very centre of the car, the sun, right out to the Oort cloud. So in the very centre of the sun, it's fusion plasma in the middle 5% of the sun, and you've got four protons, or 99%, it's four protons going into helium, producing about 2 watt per ton, and about 1% is the CNO cycle, the other cycle across there, and the amount of helium in the sun is going into the core. And so the sun started off with roughly 25% helium. It's now 50% helium in the centre as it's building up. Now the plasma in the centre of the sun is at a density gradient that the hotter it is, the denser it is, rather than the hotter it is, the less dense it is. So there's no convection in the first two-thirds of the sun out. We come up to the tachosphere. The tachosphere is the tachocline is where there's a sudden speed change, dramatic speed change, where the plasma is rotating as a rigid solid ball, i.e. the plasma is solid, yeah? That's our definition of solid. And then that you have a convection layer, which goes up, and your convection is with locked-in magnetic fields, create massive turbulence, and the basic heat of the sun creates the turbulence, which creates the solid weather, creates the differential velocity and the magnetic field. So the heat goes in the magnetic field, the generation of magnetic field then creates cells, and the magnetic field operational is contained until it reaches the surface, at which it radiates microwave radiation and boils off the solar atmosphere, creating the chromosphere, which is the colour of the sun. So if you look at the chromatic colour of the sun, you can point basically a sun width away from it and get your spectrographic light coming in to the spectrometer. It just gives you your highly ionized iron. So at the surface of the sun, it drops to 5,000 degrees, but then builds up pretty rapidly. And so this microwave radiation burns your field down and accelerates the gas to a very high temperature, which streams out in your solar wind. So this burning down basically skins your sun down to the surface of the photosphere. So suns appear hotter and bluer the more effective, not how big they are, not how much the core is. The core temperature has got nothing to do with the surface, it's the skinning down of the sun. So the bigger the sun is, the more it's skinned down, so the more this process gets down. And of course, when this process fails, the sun no longer boils off its atmosphere. And this atmosphere is a two-way process. I would admit that the solar wind must be operating in two methods, creating a downward pressure. Not that would be noted an outward pressure. The outward pressure of the solar wind extends to the heliosphere, which goes to outside the radius of easily Neptune, and creates a shock wave where the actual velocity of the solar wind matches the velocity, basic speed of the galactic gas, creating a shock wave, a bow wave, I suppose, which is seen for when you turn your tap on in the sink and let the water go down. It will go out, expand until there's a basic pressure, the pressure of your solar wave, solar wind is creating it's a vacuum pump, and it's pushing the atmospheric the galactic gas back, and the galactic gas builds up to form a shockwave of a large amount of material where it's pumping and pushing a void. Now, this is seen very much in the when young stars come out, they punch a big area within the nebula that they're formed in, and so that's our sun coming up. Now we have our first rocky planet, which is Mercury at, I don't know, it's at 95 million miles? Million kilometres. We're at 150 million kilometres, and it's inclined at 7 degrees to the ecliptic, the magnetic. So the major thing, it's got an orbital period of 80 days, or is it 96, 80 days? Highly ecliptic, elliptical orbit, and the orbit is, unlike the other ones, the orbit is rotating due to the effect of special relativity causing precession of the orbit. That is, that the actual physical distance around the sun is not 2πr as Euclidean coordinates, but the actual space itself is stretched as it goes in. And how the surface of Mercury is essentially, the silica has gone, is essentially slightly smaller than the size of our moon, but it's mostly an iron rocky core process there. And so Mercury's got, I think, still got, I think it's got volcanism on it still, and a very weak atmosphere due to the evaporation of metals on it. But the surface of Mercury is extremely, the polar regions are extremely cold because of lack of exposure to the sun. You think that you get some conduction of heat somewhere in Mercury. So that would be pretty amazing to be there. Your next planet out is Venus, which is unlike so Mercury is almost totally locked. I think it is totally locked. I'm not quite sure whether it's totally locked. Venus is actually rotating the opposite direction to its rotation of orbit, and it's got a day length just a bit short of its year, which is much shorter than our year because it's going a smaller distance. The actual orbital period is equal to the radius times the square root of the so the orbital period is equal to the, it's proportional to the radius of the orbit, which is less, but then times the square root of the orbit. So if I increase the radius of my orbit by 4, the actual period increases by 8. If I increase the radius by 9, the time increases by 27. For two reasons, in that you've got 2πr plus an additional time that its speed of rotation is slower going around for it. Now, Venus has a very thick atmosphere around it, greenhouse gas, and it's actually receiving less radiation from the sun than Earth is, because this cloud is increasing its brightness. And of course, Venus, like Mercury, shows phases, and so there's a full Venus, is a full moon, a full Venus when it's furthest away from it. So the brightness of Venus is actually at two points where you're inverse square and illumination of it. So there's sort of like, there's two points where Venus is at its brightest, because it actually dims down a little bit as it's going behind the sun. And transit of Venus, which is seen as a shadow every I think 124 years, then 11 year break between them. There's this fantastic transit, and Venus will actually walk across the surface of the sun. Beautiful view from Australia. And the thing is that as you observe it at different latitudes on Earth, the different transition times will give you, through triangulation, the exact distance, because you know your distance on Earth, and you can use the difference to calculate it, because where the Earth goes across the sun, the differences in there is a fairly simple thing to do. And so there's evidence that the surface of Venus is being refreshed, or it's going through this volcanism or whatever it is, because there's no observable craters that are seen at Saturn or Venus. Come up to Earth, and Earth's got the Moon in near circular orbit at 149 to 151 million kilometres away from Earth. The Sun. The Sun's got a full radius of 1,330,000 square kilometres. So that's and the Earth's radius is roughly 12,000 kilometres. So the Earth is a hundredth time the smallest. And so, in terms of volume, the Earth is 100 cubed, which is a millionth the volume of it. And what's it in terms of various sizes? I think Jupiter, Barnard's star, which is our second closest star, is a little bit bigger than Jupiter. So Jupiter's nearly a star. It says Jupiter's producing this star-like properties, and its nuclear fusion is causing its weathers. But all the other planets inside the solar system can, if you were to consider that Jupiter was a pumpkin, you hollowed it out, you can fit all the other planets in there quite nicely. So the Earth is another rocky planet. It's got a very thin atmosphere, 6,123 kilometres, and then 1 or 2% of that before you reach outer space. So it's a very thin surface layer on it. It's Earth has got a iron nickel core, which is still hot due to radiation. It's got an iron sulfur liquid layer in it, and that liquid layer means it's got a strong magnetic field. There's the magnetic field flips every while. The core has two sort of cylinders of magnetic rotation inside it. Two rotating cylinders either side of it, and it generates its magnetic field. The surface, the actual mantle, so it's inner core solid, outer core liquid. Mantle is a plasticky type material, and similar to the internal of the Sun, it doesn't flow. It's a magnesium and aluminium rich, or very high, basically magnesium. Yeah, it's basically a solid gemstone of overland, which is this green stuff, which is high in silicon, high in magnesium, very light stuff, and it's actually pushed as a surface, the iron out to the surface of the planet to form its tectonic plates, which sits on top of the asthenosphere. So the asthenosphere is solid and brittle and cracks And so you actually don't get earthquakes occurring in the core, because that because you can't get faults in them. But you do get in the asthenosphere, so we can see directly underneath it, and so the asthenosphere cracks and moves things around. Now, this is an incorrect idea that the core, the mantle, is undergoing convection. And in fact, it doesn't, as far as we understand. There's basically a production of crust material which moves along, and then the crust sinks into the mantle. There's a sort of chemical process, but we no longer believe that there's anything there. Now, the was it Mia? A Mars-sized planet is thought to have collided with the Moon, and the Moon is also a sort of an ovaline mantle material. And so essentially when the astronauts went out there, they found rock not dissimilar from the rock they had found around the launch pad. So for all that, we can see a few other things due to asteroid impacts. So the modelling is there. Now the Earth system is spinning down. As it's spinning down, the Moon is going further out. So the Moon is gradually travelling farther and farther away from Earth. The Moon's now tidally locked, so we always see the same surface of the Moon. So the Moon rotates in space, takes a month to rotate. So a day on the Moon takes a month, and that's just so happens that as far as the Moon is concerned, the Earth is geostationary. Yeah, so as far as the Moon is concerned, the Earth is a geostationary satellite, because the Earth's just at a position such that it's the Earth has an orbit around the Moon equal to the length of one day on the Moon. So the Earth, as far as the Earth, as the Moon is concerned, it's still rotating. It's just it's moved to a place such that the its rotation is given its central place. Now this orbit has stabilized rocking of the Earth's axis. So Mars, which has got the ellipticity of the orbit varies. I don't know whether you can hear that one. I'm coming home now. Ellipticity of the radius of the orbit varies, and conservation of angular momentum means that the actual orbit inclines, the actual pole moves towards and away from the a pole, and essentially if you have an orbit, I don't quite understand quite how this works, but if your orbit starts to move close enough to your I suppose eventually pointing into the sun, or it starts to lean, your pole, your axis begins to lean into the plane of your orbit. Essentially, I'm told that the equatorial regions cool down the most, so you get ice caps around the outside. I find that is hard to believe. So they're the rocky planets, and there is a theory that Jupiter came in, destroyed planet formation in the asteroid belt, and Sirius Ceres, which is named after the god of the harvest, is a microplanet, a small planet there, small spherical planet there, and Jupiter coming in disrupted that, but it also disrupted the planets forming into gas, into gas giants, and I've just got to remember that. So the movement of Jupiter in and out of orbit is determined by an orbital dance between Saturn and Uranus and Neptune is working. Now, the interesting thing is that Uranus is far out, that Neptune is twice as far out. I think it's 340,000. We're 150. So we're 150 million kilometres from it, so I have to remember 150. So we are definitely 150 million kilometres, and the distance of the moon Earth thing is 1/400th of it. So the moon is using that 1 to 400. I think the moon is sufficiently close to us. So if the so it's basically, if the moon was 150,000 kilometers away, it would be 1/100th. It's 1/400, so it's 4/150. So it's a bit under. It's a bit varying. A bit under 300, or 390,000 kilometers. So it's 1.25 light seconds away. Jupiter's the next big planet, and its red dot is getting less red, more fawn, and much smaller fraction. And it's got I really don't understand their explanation of orbital heating, but it has four large moons. Io is the closest moon, and it's there's Callisto, Ganymede, and Europa, and one of them is very the other one has no plate tectonics, therefore lots of craters. The other ones have got potentially liquid inside them, the other two inside of them, and they form in resonance, I think a 2-3 resonance, 2-3 resonance with the other ones. I think it's Io, Ganymede, Callisto. No, gee, can't remember that. And I think there's 67 moons and a ring around Jupiter, a thin rocky ring, getting up to Saturn. The orbit of Jupiter, the orbits of the rooms of Jupiter form a very precise clock, and when you compensate for the speed of light and the orbital speed of light, that can be used as one of the astronomical guides to give very accurate time. And this was used by Captain Cook. This observation was used by Captain Cook rather than his reliance on Harrison's clock, to S5H5. I don't know if it's not sort of they ripped it off. Poor bastard. Yeah, it's sort of just a typical. It's sort of a typical thing to go. So the orbits of Jupiter vary by basically 16 minutes, because it's 8 minutes light minutes for the sun to travel from us to the Earth. So if the Jupiter is sitting almost directly behind the sun, there's an extra quarter of an hour of light time travel to get to us. But if the Jupiter is the sun, say if Jupiter at the moment where Jupiter's high in the middle of the night, so Jupiter's on the far side, it's got less, so there's that amount of time. I think it's also observed with Saturn. Yes, Saturn has been known since ancient time. It has a ring which may be less than 10 million years old due to ice collision, and it's a thin ring, only a couple of metres thin, so it's one of the thinnest structures in existence. It's not something like incredibly thin compared to paper thin. I just have to remember the thing. It's got a gap in it due to a moon rolling in the gap. I think one moon which is in the gap has got a very large range in it due to the stuff falling in through. I think there's something to do with charge going through it. And of course, one of the moons of is it Europa? Europa is on Saturn. Is that right? There's Triton. Where they've actually put a lander on there, on the moon. Brain's gone completely flat. What the heck's gone completely flat on? Now Saturn has got the same colourings as Jupiter, much smaller. Something to do with its core. And so Jupiter and Saturn are the two gas giants. Afterwards comes the ice giants. They're not gas, but they're so-called, they're icy. Uranus is rotating on its axis. Its axis is pointing pretty much towards the south, sorry, to the plane of the ecliptic. So undergoing a collision, and its rings, so Uranus has rings in it, and it's got, I think, 26 planets named after Shakespearean characters. But Triton is a Cajun moon. It's going in the opposite direction to the other moons around it. But it's really interesting, the orbital mechanics, means that the moons and the rings all go out. The rings, they have seen just really briefly, have a shepherding moons on either side of them, and I think Triton's got volcanic activity, but Uranus is virtually featureless, and it's a blue colour. Neptune's also almost twice as far out again, and it's blue. I can't remember about the moons of Neptune. It's one cloud on it, and I can't really remember too much about it. After that, the next world that is Pluto. So Pluto was filmed in 2015 by New Horizons space probe, which was the first one to actually basically go in hibernation and switch on after many years, enough to film a few hours of flyby coming into it. And so there's Pluto and its gravitationally locked neighbour called Charon, and there was a various features on Pluto, including a harp-shaped cardioid on it, and evidence of convection bubbles on the on one of the seas there, indicating there's still an active heat source in Pluto. So it gives you the ranges of it, and you're going up to the beyond there to the heliopause, where the solar radiation comes up. The solar wind has got a fast and slow coming out from different parts of the sun, and the fast and slow creates a series of catenarial shock waves which grow beyond Earth, meaning that there's sort of a constant blowing of solar wind. So rather than us, which we get a fairly constant solar wind, the solar wind slows and fits and starts up. So you don't see it, but comes towards you, so it rises and falls rhythmically. I've forgotten what the name of this helical pattern is. So that's your ice giants, and then your lots of items up in the accreted belt, which is a sort of a disc, and an Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is of objects which travel up to 2 light years, or half the way to Alpha Centauri, of these objects which are there, which just makes it pretty interesting solar system. And that's as best the data dump I can do, and I think that's, yeah, I just have to keep on going through it so I can actually recall this type of stuff. Now, I don't know whether other teachers have to do it as much, but apparently they're concerned about me memorising things. Okay, thanks a lot for listening, and all the best out there in various overseas countries.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.